I'm Carrie Miller, now in depth with the Friday Roundtable. This is the show where we invite three smart and interesting people into the studio to talk about the week's news or a big idea. Today, we're returning to our theme of six things. Guante, the hip-hop artist, brought it to us with six things he wished he'd known starting out as an artist. Now, we've expanded it, and today we've invited three entrepreneurs in for a candid conversation about what they wish they'd known at the beginning of starting their companies. And I hope you'll join in, too. What do you wish you'd known at the beginning of your chosen career? How might it have made a difference? You can go to the Daily Circuit page and click on the roundtable heading, or you can tweet me now at Carrie MPR. Our roundtablers, Nina Hale, is founder and CEO of Nina Hale, Inc., a search engine marketing firm. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Jeffrey Lynn Nelson is founder and CEO of Play From Scratch, a toy company. Before he started the company, he worked in public affairs right here at Minnesota Public Radio. So cool to have you in the studio.
It's great to be back.
And Jill Johnson is with us. She's founder and president of Johnson Consulting Services. She was recently inducted into the Minnesota Women's Business Owners Hall of Fame. Congratulations. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So I'm going to start with the fact that all of you come to the roundtable with varying levels of experience, varying times that you started the company and that you've had a chance to build up some knowledge. But I'm wondering if you can each say, going into the ventures, if you really knew what you didn't know. Jeff, how about you?
You know, that's a funny question because I forwarded my list to one of my mentors last night. And he immediately responded about 3 seconds later, oh, you knew this stuff already. So then I had to rethink and realize actually there are a lot of things I didn't know. It's easy to jump to the things that I did know, but that I had to work hard for. It's the tough stuff is what I didn't know.
Is it the stuff that you'd rather not admit that you didn't know?
Well, sometimes it's so basic, that
really?
You hate to admit it. But yeah, you look back and you say, wow, I can't believe I didn't do that.
Nina,
on day one.
Basic stuff, Nina?
Basic stuff is more about work style and growth that I didn't know. I didn't know that I always thought I was going to be me alone. And now I've got 37 employees. So a lot of it is based around that growth idea.
Jill, did you know what you... Now, you've done this. How long has it been since you started your company?
I have been making my living as a consultant for over 30 years.
Wow.
I was an infant when I started. And I've had my own business now for 26. But I'm a child of entrepreneurs. I'm a fourth-generation entrepreneur. So for me, the lifestyle was something that I fully understood. But I went and learned how to be a professional consultant on somebody else's nickel by working in one of the world's largest management consulting practices and volunteered for everything and anything. But even then, I was still very young when I left, and I had to wait till I aged out before things really started to fully come together.
Okay, so what did you not know that you, maybe a couple years into it, you thought, boy, if I'd known that, or... I should have known that.
I think, I was always really good at networking. And in professional development for service businesses, you need to be able to network because everything you get work-wise comes off of relationships. But back then, we didn't have the technology for capturing. We didn't even have internet when I started my business. So there were no email addresses for all the people that I worked with. And having to build that, the keeping connected to people was much more difficult. And I never, we had the old little cards that my mother would type up when I would get a business card. And so you'd have to type up labels and handwrite addresses back then. And creating your own capacity for managing your network, I think, is much easier now. But back in the early days, I didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about
it.
And then when my mom passed away and I didn't have somebody to just magically type those addresses in anymore, that became a much bigger deal. And then having to go back and rebuild a database to get email addresses for people just to find new ways to stay in touch with them. It required some new thought. And technology is not my special strong suit. So that was a big learning curve. I have to incorporate that.
I thought you guys might say something like, I had the optimism that with enough elbow grease and time and energy and passion invested into this, it would all work out. and maybe deeper into the venture, and Jeff, we can test this with you, but deeper into the venture, Nina, you realize you need more than that. Tell me what you think about that.
Well, I think that that's a big part of it. I mean, you need the optimism of it, but you also need the expertise. And one of it is that when you grow, your own expertise is not necessarily everybody else's. Everybody has gaps in what they can offer and their knowledge. So one of the most important things, and that I learned, is making sure that as I grew, that I was bringing in people with other expertise and people who had other work styles and other ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. Part of that is confusing because it also meant that not everybody does things in the same amount of time. So I would scope everything for the same amount of time that it would take me to do it and not necessarily realize, well, somebody else has a different work process, and so it might take them a different amount of time. So that was one of the biggest ones in terms of that type of change.
How's that fit with you guys?
You know, I think she's right on the money. I mean, we all have gaps in our skill set. And the key is, how do you fill those gaps? Whether you bring on staff or you use independent contractors or you hire outside advisors. Because a skill set like mine, most organizations don't need to have full-time on staff. But a skill set like what Nina brings to the table, they may have some piece of it on staff, but they don't have the level of sophistication necessarily to bring themselves to the next level. And that's when you bring those outside people in. But it's hard. It can get very lonely when you're in your business. And if you don't have networks set up to provide you with that emotional sustenance, if you will. Exactly.
Yeah, why is it lonely?
Well, and this is sort of weird, but, you know, I started my business in 2005, and actually my business was growing like crazy through the recession, because what we do is a growing advertising field. And one of the loneliest things was actually trying to talk to friends who are really struggling in their lives about, oh gosh, I'm so busy because I have so much work coming in. And you can't do that. You're just going to be a jerk.
It's tough. Yeah. Because if you have these enormous successes and they're struggling because their life is just not economically working out the way they thought, or they presume, oh, you must have so much money because you're an entrepreneur, you can just pay for all these things. It's hard to be really candid. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, too, I mean, we're all in a situation as executives and CEOs of our businesses, we have to project confidence or the public and our clients won't buy from us. But every one of us has days of panic and terror when you want to crawl into the fetal position. And being able to have a support system that will help you regroup when you're just not having a good day like that is important, too. And being able to have friends who can celebrate the successes.
Jeff, panic and terror.
Oh, there's a lot of panic and terror. But at the same time, you know, it can be lonely. You know, I'm the only full-time employee of Play From Scratch. But I do have great people around me. I have a board of advisors that's fantastic. And early on, I had this process, and I called it meeting with superheroes, where I'd go out and I'd buy breakfast for friends or acquaintances, people I know that were just excellent in their field. And I felt like it's kind of like that Mission Impossible, where it's like your mission if you choose to accept it. I'd sit down, you know, at breakfast, and I'd describe Play From Scratch and the brilliant ideas that I had for building a whole new kind of toy. And then I'd say, so, and lean in and see if they would bite. And some of them did. And they came on as consultants, contractors, as advisors. And that was fantastic. And so the loneliness went away very fast, because now I can pick up the phone anytime or drop an email to somebody, and they're going to, you know, they're a rock star at what they do, and they're going to give me great advice.
Yeah, but how about the, where I thought you guys were going to go on this is, how about the moment when you have that first recognition that this is really all on me? Yes, I can surround myself with really smart people and that's going to matter. But in the end, it's how creative can I be? How innovative can I be? Do I have this stuff to really make this work?
When businesses, as they grow, go through different seminal phases, when you hit like 10 employees, 25 employees, 50 employees. And when we were at about 25 employees, and before I had more people who were really in there taking control of a lot of things, which other people did, that's where I really felt the most loneliness, because I felt absolutely that I was I was the last person in charge of everything. So if it didn't work out, you know, if there was a mistake and we weren't getting good results for a client, if somebody didn't like the job, if there was, you know, people didn't like where we were working, anything, and just making the payroll, that all came to me. And it did feel crushing for a while, where I felt like I had so much responsibility that was put on me for that. And that was actually, in the entire time where I've been thinking about growing and where do I decide to grow more or less, mm-hmm. it has been in some of that type of thing. And the risk of saying, wow, at this point, you know, my payroll mm-hmm. is more than my mortgage in case things go south.
Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah. Talk about panic and terror right there. Wow.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We're doing a roundtable of entrepreneurs, all with varying amounts of experience starting their own companies. And we're kind of applying our six things template to the conversation. So I've asked them all to come to the studio with the six things they know now that they wish they'd known at the beginning. Our entrepreneurs, Nina Hale, founder and CEO of Nina Hale, Inc., Jill Johnson, she's founder and president of Johnson Consulting Services, and Jeff Freeland Nelson, he's founder and CEO of Play From Scratch. A little disclosure here, he used to work at NPR, but he left to start his own business. So, Jeff, I want to talk about the thing that ended up on the top of your six things list. Where did you begin?
So, again, something that I should have known is corner your customer first.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I knew from day one who my ideal customer was, and that was Creative Kid Stuff. It's a great toy company, a toy store here in the Twin Cities. So as Play From Scratch, I wanted to get our product in there. So we actually rented an office across the street. I spent a lot of time inside the store. I talked to their staff.
Yeah.
You know, I shopped. I did everything that you're supposed to do. But what I didn't do is talk to the buyer, the person who's actually making the decisions about what product is on the shelf.
How come?
I wanted to be ready. You know, I wanted something that was polished and done, like I could present. So, you know, 6 months later and, you know, a lot of money later, we have product. It's ready to go. And then I get that meeting with the buyer at Creative Kid Stuff, and I walk in, present everything, and she says, I love it, but we're not going to buy it. And I said, well, why? And she said, well, because I love it, but unfortunately, you know, this green product, I mean, something that's so, I mean, we're an eco-friendly toy company. It's too green. And then went on to describe what she really wanted. And so 6 months later, I walked in with Yoxo, which is a brand new product. And I really have to say, verbatim, that's like, you remember you wanted it to hang on a peg? Well, look, it hangs on a peg. Everything I could do to meet the needs of that one customer, Creative Kid Stuff, now suddenly we have a product that's selling across the country and selling really well.
Wow. So I wonder if there was a little of, but if I ask the buyer now, a few months in, and she says no, but I'm committed to this thing. I mean, when I wonder, am I playing the psychology,
you know,
here too
much? There's
a
lot of second guessing. I mean, it's certainly, there are times where I think, if I had had this conversation a year ago.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you realize that you never would have gotten there. You know, you have to go through these iterations. You have to stumble. I mean, and the product that we created actually did very well selling direct to consumer during the holiday season. It just wasn't retail friendly enough.
Yeah.
We needed something that really would work on a store shelf. And they gave us the advice to create Yoxo and make that happen.
Jill, I thought Jeff just said you have to stumble. Obviously, there was something really important in the learning of that. Did you have those moments?
You know, sure. I mean, I think because I was so young when I left the big firm to go out on my own, I thought, oh, the work will just follow. But the truth was, is I had been working with major clients and major enterprises and had been networking and doing a lot of speaking and promotion to that small business arena. Well, small businesses didn't have any money. And the big companies, I didn't have a big enough flag, if you will, for them to hire me. And so even though I had the skill set, I didn't quite have the gravitas and the moxie. So I was very fortunate, though, that I had some clients from the big firm that followed me. They wanted that world-class expertise, but they didn't want to pay world-class prices for it. So price discounting was an opportunity for me to get my foot in the door to build experience under my own business umbrella and learning to leverage those experiences to then finally be compensated at an appropriate rate. But I tell people, don't give it all away for free, because it's very easy to do that, because everybody wants to just, quote, pick your brain. And if all you sell is your time and they pick your brain and there's no cash connection between the two. And the other part of it, and I think this is the part I was really good at, was bootstrapping and being careful about money. I did not spend all my money up front. I had a lot of money in savings I'd been planning for the departure for quite a long time. But I, like you, Nina, we were talking offline, I wasn't quite ready for when the timing happened. I got laid off, and it was just great. I've been set free, but it was still terrifying because I didn't have all of my full ducks in a row. But I had been saving and preparing for that. And I think that for most businesses, cash management is a really difficult thing for a small enterprise, because the bills don't necessarily stop if the cash isn't coming in as fast as you would like it to. And being able to manage that cash flow, because you have to pay taxes. That was a shock for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I was very excited about having to pay quarterly taxes until about the end of the first year, when I really actually had to write the checks out to the government for that quarter, going,
yeah,
I could buy a new computer with that. And, you know, you start thinking about all the other things that you could
and
invest in.
And I'm sending
in
it off never to be seen
exactly.
again, right?
The government.
So, Nina, look at your list and tell me what's at the top of it.
You know, what was at the top for me is really that you need to determine what your priorities are, because everybody goes into it for something different. Some people, it might be money, it might be prestige, it might be fun. I want to do this. And, you know, some people are going into because they really want to make a difference in people's lives. So the fact is that a lot of these things do not intersect. And so you really have to determine what it is that you want to get out of it and what is going to make you happy. Because, you know, if you don't, you're always going to be rubbing up against this thing that you're kind of not all that happy. And if you're not passionate and really liking what you do, all the joy in your life is going to get sucked out of your life, because it is a crushing amount of work that you put in starting your own business.
You know, along with that, you know, the priorities for me early on, it was really about the toys, right? I had an idea for a design and for a kind of toy that didn't exist out there. And then what happens over time is the business starts to take off, and then you can put all your time into the business. So the top of my list is art first, business second.
No.
Because soon I found myself walking around with these gorgeous projections and a beautiful business plan to meet with investors and advisors. But I would go for a week or a month without ever making anything. And then I realized, well, wait a second. I got into this because I wanted to make these toys. So suddenly I had to have this discipline, actually the discipline of doing what I wanted to do first, and then letting all that other stuff, important stuff, business stuff, but stuff that could wait, because we needed to have a really beautiful product before anything else.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel the kind of joy in this that Nina, you know, puts on her list, or is that still, are you still trying to grab onto that?
You know, there's this idea of flow and lost time.
Yeah.
If I have time when I can actually sit down and actually make the toys. Today, I was trying to design a Yaxo Roadster. And what happens is I lose time. You know, I'll suddenly go, oh, whoa, I've got to get to NPR. If I'm doing the spreadsheets and doing the business stuff, I enjoy it. I mean, I actually really enjoy that stuff. But I'm very aware of what time it is. So that tells you something.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We're having a conversation about the six things that three entrepreneurs brought into the studio that they wish they'd known at the beginning of starting their companies. Maybe you're thinking about starting a company and you're learning some things here in the conversation. I'd be interested in hearing about that. You can go to the Daily Circuit page and click on the Roundtable heading, or you can tweet me at @CarrieMPR. What in your own career, and maybe you started a business, what do you wish you'd known at the beginning, and what kind of a difference might it have made? Jeff Freeland Nelson with us, Jill Johnson and Nina Hale. I'm Carrie Miller. Tweet me at @CarrieMPR. You can go to the Daily Circuit page and click on the Roundtable heading. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation.
Topping the hour's news, the St. Cloud Catholic Diocese has a new bishop. The St. Cloud Times is reporting this hour that Donald Kettler will be named the bishop today to replace Bishop John Kinney, who is retiring. Kettler is currently bishop in Fairbanks, Alaska. He's been bishop there for more than a decade. He was born in Minneapolis and graduated from St. John's University. The organization that keeps tabs on compliance with a chemical weapons treaty says Syria has sent an initial declaration that outlines its weapons program. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons is looking at ways to speed up efforts to secure and destroy Syria's arsenal of poison gas and nerve agents, as well as its production facilities. Diplomatic efforts, though, to move that process along are proceeding slowly. At least 18 people are dead after a pair of bombs that were hidden inside air conditioners exploded today in a Sunni mosque north of Baghdad. The mosque was packed with worshippers during Friday prayers. A local official in the city of Samarra says this explosion also wounded more than 20 people and that the mosque is heavily damaged. And that's the latest news here on the Daily Circuit.
The next time someone asks what happened this summer, tell them about Minnesota.
Live from the Minnesota State Fair.
The same right as every other American to marry the person we love.
Tell them what happened in the United States.
Just allow him to know some of my life stories and what was going on with me and that it was going to be okay.
And tell them about the world.
Because we cannot resolve someone else's civil war through force.
Your support makes the news possible. Thank you for being a member of Minnesota Public Radio News. News that connects. Programming is supported by The Guthrie, now playing a new adaptation of Anton Chekhov's Uncle Vanya by Irish dramatist Brian Friel. Playing now through October 27th on The Guthrie's Wordle Thrust stage. More information at GuthrieTheater.org. Programming is supported by Højgaard's 45th Annual Tent Event. Downhill and cross-country skis, snowboards, outerwear, and more today through Sunday. Highway 100 and Excelsior Boulevard in St. Louis Park. More information at Højgaards.com.
Read more about this hour's topics and leave a comment. Click on The Daily Circuit at mprnews.org.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is the Friday Roundtable. Three entrepreneurs with the six things that they wish they'd known when they started their businesses. Nina Hale with us, founder and CEO of Nina Hale, Inc. Jeff Freeland Nelson, founder and CEO of Play From Scratch. And Jill Johnson, founder and president of Johnson Consulting Services. Jill, look on your list of six things and pull another one out, will you?
Well, tying off of what was talked about earlier, the thing for me that I didn't pay enough attention to was taking care of my health and making time for those relationships. It is so easy when people are bombarding you with the I wants. I want you to come do this. I need you to respond to that. I need an email. You know, and I can go days where I work 18 hours a day and, you know, my husband will just give me a plate of food and then leave for his own protection. And you get consumed in the work, especially if you're in a business like mine that's very much, it's all in your head. And so you're trying to solve a problem and that. But those 18-hour days sitting in front of a computer took their toll, both in terms of weight, back issues, you know, herniated discs and things like that. And so what I've had to work really hard on over the last 2 years is to actually put me first. I make appointments now for exercise because it's the only
way. Do you really?
It is. It's the only way I can get it on my schedule. And not every week is perfect, but I have any class that I could maybe go to is all booked in. And then I adjust each day. And I've lost 40 pounds in the last year or so and healthier and more vibrant. And I'm going to live a longer life because I finally recognize that you can't just all be in your head. You have to be whole into your body as
well.
You
know, I think that thing that you just said about it's in your head, I would think that's one of the challenges for all three of you is you've lived with this vision for a long time of what this can be. And then bringing other people into Nina, yes, you get this, in really understanding, recognizing, and really buying into your vision.
I think that that's a great point in a couple of different ways, one of which is how do you express your own vision and that whole sort of thing of priorities. Because my priority for the business, and this means that it affects every single person in the business, my priority is prestige. So I want to be known as the absolute best at this, at what we do. And that matters to me more than other elements. I mean, they all matter to me because, I have to make money and everything else. But that's the most important thing. So that I need to make sure that I'm always letting people know that. And as you ramp up, you bring in more people, you're not necessarily telling them and sharing that. And also, you know, somebody who might be an entrepreneur is somebody who's racing forward. You're like saying charge. And then you look back and you're like, oh my gosh, where is everybody? They're all behind me. And not because they're slow or anything else. It's just that you know in your head what's happening. And we make jokes like this all the time where I always say, well, I gave you a laptop. What else do you need? And so you have to be very explicit and very clear about people's job expectations, about people's job duties, and about how you are going to be able to fill their own desires and needs and priorities, because you have, it's not just you anymore. It's what everybody else's is. And so a lot of that is stopping and learning what that is and making sure that you not only tell people really clearly what you're expecting of them, but you learn what they're expecting of themselves as well.
I think this thing about prestige is really interesting just for a minute here, because that can be a subjective understanding mm-hmm. from different, you know, my idea of what prestige is could be really different than from what yours is. So how do you communicate? Talk to me about how you're actually communicating that part of the vision.
Well, you know, we're a service based, we're an ad agency, and we're very numbers oriented. So we do like e-commerce lead generation. So we have really specific benchmarks and numbers that we can measure. We measure everything. So we can measure how much did we improve your business. And now that this has been a business for a while, a lot of times people will come to us and they have benchmarks from the other agency that they were working with. So then we can say how much better were we than the other group.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of it, is that we can measure it and around that and benchmark. And a lot of that is this communication of, you know, for us, there's a ton of education and we're all educating each other all the time and going to conferences and sharing this information. But that's sort of one of the main ways that we can try to make sure that we're aware that that's one of our main goals. But it is hard because sometimes people will say, oh gosh, we're going over on this client. We're putting in more work than we got paid for. And we constantly have to make this hard decision to say, well, you know what? We haven't been able to hit what we want to, what our goal was. And so we have to go over. And that's just a growth thing of learning how to scope over time.
You know, for a toy company, it's not necessarily about prestige, but it's about value, this idea of how you create value. And not just for yourself as a company, obviously we need to make money in order to survive, but also for your partners like Creative Kids Stuff, for other toy retailers, and then ultimately how are you creating value for the parent, the grandparent, and the kid who's playing with that toy. And it's really tough because the toy business is a challenging business. I mean, people are not spending hundreds of dollars on sort of creative toys like what we make. Really, they want to spend $15, $20. So how do you make something that costs you $2, $3, $4 to make the materials and then sell it to someone for $20? And, you know, academically, it's easy to see, well, of course, you know, that's easy. And then you have to do it and you realize, no, there's so many things from, you know, the polish to the design to, you know, how dense the materials, how durable it feels. All of those pieces have to add up in the minds of the customer. And then again, ultimately that kid and how much fun and creative fun that kid is having to say, okay, that's worth it. I'll give you $20 for that. And that is really, really hard to do.
You know, and I think as I look at spinning off of the other two, for me, it's impact. And when I go into a client, if I'm involved in a turnaround, and it's an enterprise-wide turnaround, and I'm dealing with their board of directors, their senior management, and then once we get the strategies in place that are based on real market information, competitor intelligence, as well as the internal reviews, then I'm working with their other key mid-level managers to try and figure out operationally how do we roll this all out. I never usually get to see the result of how it might affect their end product. So, for example, I have a client I did a massive turnaround for 8 years ago now, and I'm still working with that client periodically, but all of the, it was a senior living community, and all of the residents that were touched, they have over 500 seniors who live there, independent living all the way through skilled. I have affected the quality of the end of their lives, and over the last 30 years, that is the work that I do. I affect so many other people that never have heard of Jill Johnson from Johnson Consulting Services. And for me, that's the moment when my dad told me when I was getting ready to name my business, and he owned a small auto body repair shop in Hudson called Johnson's Body Shop. My brother still owns it. And he said, your name better be in the business name. And I'm like, well, why? I mean, I'm going to be like Siegel Consulting or something. And he said, if it's not good enough to put your name on it, it's not good enough to go out the door. And to this day, I cannot sign off on a final report unless the report is fully done and really ready for my name, because that's the legacy then that gets used and has effect. And sometimes, you know, it's not easy because organizations that are in trouble don't like to change, and they maybe don't really want to hear the truth. And sometimes I have, you know, I'm in a battle with, you know, major community leaders, somebody who was a commissioner from a state agency. And you have to be bold enough in those moments to tell them the truth in a way that they understand and can see how the impact of the change is going to result in. And then you've got to figure out how to filter it down. For me, the impact is the passion, and that then builds to the prestige and the cachet that you end up building. But I'm not the one you want to hire if you want touchy-feely, find your center wishcraft.
I'm getting that sense.
Nah, yeah. If you want concrete and you really want to solve the problem, then give me a holler.
But what's the best advice that you got, Nina, when you were starting out?
I'm trying to remember the exact best advice. I think it was sort of just to make sure that the processes were together. But some of the best advice that I read, so I guess that I did get early on, is that you are going to have to make hard decisions.
Oh.
And some of that is that you're going to have to fire people. And you're going to have to fire people who are nice people. Luckily, I haven't been in a situation where I've had to let people go because of growth issues. I'm terrified for that might happen someday, you know, and we're very, very careful about that. But you're going to have to discipline people and tell them that they didn't do as good of a job as they should have. And you're going to have to ask people to work over the weekends. You're going to have to cancel your own vacations. And so there's a lot of hard decisions that if you want to build a world-class or a Midwestern, Minnesota-class company, that you are going to have to make some of these decisions that are going to really be painful for you spiritually.
Jeff, what's the best advice you got? Fairly recently, right?
Right, yeah.
I was gonna say,
last week. No, it's been about a year and a half. And,
okay.
You know, the best advice that I got really early on was just do it. You know, I sat down with... I can't tell you how many people that I would sit down and tell them that I was, you know, this was before I planned to jump off the cliff.
Yes.
And they would get so excited. And then somehow, for some odd reason, they tended to reach across the table and shake my hand, you know, at wherever we were. and just gave me that sense that, you know, this is going to be okay, that that you can take this crazy risk. You know, I've got two little kids at home. Luckily, I'm very understanding.
Until they're like me and work with you in your business. You know, and my dad had me pushing a broom.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, my wife is amazing and very understanding of the craziness of this all. But it was those few people early on that I sat down with and said, I'm thinking of doing this, that said, yeah, you should do this. That was great advice.
You know, that we haven't talked about risk yet. And isn't that the key thing for an entrepreneur to really have a clear understanding of the kind of risk you're mm-hmm. undertaking, and then being able to say, maybe this isn't part of the equation, but I think I would ask myself, what's the worst thing that can happen if the risk doesn't turn out? Yes,
mm-hmm, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things that I tried to address before as I was doing my business planning. And I had been recruited by a headhunter to work for one of the other large CPA firms. And I didn't like the guys I interviewed with, so I turned it down. But as it was getting closer to the time where I really knew, I mean, I had strangers coming up to me after speaking engagements. When are you going to start your business? It was like, is it a neon on my forehead? But I called the recruiter back. And we met for lunch. And when I sat down, because I told her, I said, I have something serious I want to talk to you about. And when we sat down, she said, so when are you leaving to start your business? And I just looked at her and I said, are you kidding me? I said, am I going to screw up my entire career if I do this? And she started laughing at me, which really wasn't what I was expecting. She said, Jill, if you're back with me in 2 years, it'll be because you're looking to hire somebody. And that was, for me, the final affirmation, even though I was terrified when the layoff happened and then I was really, the universe saying, are you really going to do this? Or are you going to go see if you can get that other job again?
Right.
But I had this headhunter's point in my head. She and all these other people believed that I was really ready. And so even though, again, I look at some young people that I mentor now that are as old as I was then, and I'm like, what the hell was I thinking? My God, and they were so young. But I just trusted that I would fly. I made a sale my first day. It was all of like $200, but it was a sale and it counted. And, you know, the rest was history. I mean, there have been big sales, there have been little sales, there have been, you know, projects that I really wanted and projects that I didn't get, but you learn to live in that element of risk. And I think for me, the family that I grew up in, you know, body shop is a bit of a seasonal business. We used to get very excited when there were snowstorms, and because Dad was always happy.
People are going to crash into each other.
Exactly.
And need body work.
You know, they'll hit the tree. But you know, my parents were really disciplined about money, and they saved for the rainy day. If they had a good 6 months, you know, they didn't go out and spend it on everything. They set money aside in reserve, and I've had that level of discipline. And so, you know, it's allowed me to both build net worth. I have money that's not available for my business. I have, you know, invested in my home and other resources, but it still allows me to manage the risk. But I still worry about those things, but it's easier as you get through it and you fight through it.
You know, my amazing wife, have I mentioned she's amazing? Yeah. When we decided to start the business, and really it is something you decide, you know, with your spouse. We talked about what's the worst case scenario, and we really sort of dug in, like, okay, well, what if it was worse than that? What if it was worse than
exactly.
that? And we realized that really the worst case scenario was we put everything we've got into this business, and if for some odd reason doesn't work out, and we lose our house, and we have to move into the basement with my parents.
Or
my
that
parents,
would be
my
the
parents'
worst
basement
case,
in Iowa. And then we looked at each other
That's
and thought.
Funny.
And we actually said, well, that wouldn't be so bad. They've got a fully stocked fridge. They've got a nice house. The kids would love it. So suddenly it said, okay, well, now we know what the worst case scenario is. That's not so bad. And then you sort of work from there. And I, you know, I want my investors to understand that that's never going to happen. We're long past that point. But, you know, risk is a huge part of this kind of undertaking. And you get to the point where, I mean, if you even explain to me 2 years ago the situation I'm in now, I'd be like, are you crazy? But you just get to the point where you say, no, I'm in it. There's nowhere to go but forward. And you get these little successes. You know, right now we're getting all these little successes that suddenly make you realize, oh, okay, this is going to happen.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We've asked three entrepreneurs to come into the studio with the six things they wish they'd known when they started the business. Jeff Freeland Nelson with us, Jill Johnson, and Nina Hale. I'm Carrie Miller. Nina, how did you think about risk when you started?
I'm very risk averse. And
are
so
you?
I do not, you know, I have a service-based business. And so, you know, almost all of our you know, finances are caught up in human capital. And so in the people. And so I actually, at one point I kind of hit a thing where I actually felt a little bit less concerned about the risk because I thought, well, it's at this point, the company isn't going to go under if something terrible happens. But we have very few clients. We have a lot of clients. So we have maybe 50 clients at any given time. So none of our clients have any large, no client compromises more than 12% of our total annual fees. So
okay,
that helps.
Forgive me for interrupting.
Yeah,
you're
sorry.
Giving me the...
Yeah,
the,
I'm giving you the...
You're giving
gritty.
Me the... No, yeah. But you're giving me the numbers of it. I want emotional side of the risk that you thought about.
So the emotional risk, again, because, you know, I was talking about my priorities.
Yeah.
So the emotional risk for me starts first with the prestige, where the risk for me, the biggest risk for me is failure. And so that... what if we do a terrible job? What if somebody hates me? What if, you know, Minnesota is incredible. It's all through networking. You get all of your work through networking. And so what if, one, somebody just doesn't think highly of me or my business? They're sort of the same thing right now anymore. And so that is the bigger risk. But the financial risk is terrifying, too, because, you know, Nina's plan is not to lose money. You know, that's not in the grand scheme of things. And so... so we, you know, we always have these sort of crunch times where we're really a little bit too busy, and then we can hire more people. But I think that for me, again, that risk really does get into the prestige-based thing, which then relates directly to the money afterwards.
You know, you guys know this. Everybody admires the risk-taker that succeeds. Mm-hmm. But did you worry about being the having to come back to whoever, Jeff, NPR, Nina, wherever you were working, Jill, the company you got laid off from, or people hearing, well, they tried it and it just didn't work out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think for me, it was as I was going through the transitions of the clients that I could sell it when I was 28 to 30 to 35 mm-hmm. years old to the next level of client and the next level. Anytime you're in that leaping transition, you may go for a while where nobody says yes, or you have to do five bids that you don't get. And for me, every bid is, it's personal. It's a failure if I don't get the bid. I may have come in second. And, you know, second is nice, but it doesn't pay your bills. But you use, if you use each of those learning experiences, I would go back to the people that I the prospective client and say, you know, what could I have done differently on the proposal? What was the tipping point to the other firm? And just as Jeff was saying earlier, asking the buyer started informing me on how I needed to tweak the proposal, how I needed to tweak the case study. And so for me, I could have walked away at any one of those points because the fear of not being successful. And I wanted to work with more successful clients, higher prestige because there's bigger money. And it really got the emotional dynamic of that was very difficult to manage through.
Yeah.
But I think that's where you really find out, am I really an entrepreneur? And, you know, because entrepreneur is it's a life as much as anything else. And it and for me, I realized that all of the things that make me an exceptional consultant did not make me an exceptional employee. I didn't work very well for other people because I'm a little too blunt and too bold. And that's hard in most organizations to live with daily. But it's good to bring it in and out. But I had to really face that mirror of, my God, am I ever going to sell anything again? And then all of a sudden you go to the post office and a proposal that the client, the prospect stopped returning your calls about. All of a sudden you have a signed contract in a mailbox and you're like, really? How the hell did that happen? And then bang, that was the precipice to push you up to the whole next level. And that happened to me more than once.
You give up a lot. I mean, I won't lie to you. You know, you give up that paycheck that shows up every 2 weeks. You give up benefits, you give up, you know, all these things that are really important. But, you know, you also gain something. And it's easy to get stuck in either the present or the future. It's easy to get stuck in that place where you're thinking, someday this is going to be a huge company. Someday I'm going to sell it and it's going to be awesome. And you can't get stuck way out in the future. You need to plan for it. You need to be thinking about it. But at the same time, you also need to be here right now and say, you know, this is kind of awesome. I have control of my destiny for the most part. I have tons of flexibility. I can be a great dad and be a great business person at the same time. You know, I devote myself to that because the flexibility allows me to do that. I'm working all the time, but I'm also kind of a dad all the time. And so there's a real balance that comes from that that is valuable to me now. And makes it worth giving up, you know, the paycheck and all of those other important things.
Nina, look down on your list for one of the other six things that you brought to us.
Well, I think one thing is the time is that, you know, you are going to be working an enormous amount of time. Mm-hmm. When I first went out on my own, I thought I was going to be working 30-hour work weeks and I was just going to take a couple of clients and have long lunches and things. And for the first 6 years, I did not ever work less than a 60-hour work week, ever. And it was very frequently way more than that. And so that's one of the really big things that you give up. But again, it is sort of that question that as you grow, a lot of the things that you loved doing that you started the business to do, you will stop doing. And so you have to be flexible in understanding that trade-off. And I always used to say, you know, because I really resisted any growth for the first 2 years. And I said, you know, the path to glory leads but to the grave all the time, over and over again. And then, you know, I switched because I didn't want to say no. And I don't think you should say no. And that was another thing is that a friend of mine who is successful and has done this well, she said, don't say no. These other two women who were doing it, they were taking work, and it's like you work harder or you hire people as long as you know that you can actually deliver what you promise and that you can deliver on time, that you don't say no to projects. And that was another really big thing that I had to sort of determine, do I want this? How do I want this business to be? What is important to me? And the fact was that the roads to glory was more important to me
now,
than the grave.
I want to understand now, what the roads to glory lead to the grave. What is that? What does that really mean?
It's a quote. I mean, it's a quote from a poem,
yeah.
And it was, I think it was actually about wartime and everything.
But for you,
but
it
for
said
me,
what?
it was around that prestige of me being able to say, you know, not just, you know, I'm going to go to a cocktail party and somebody's going to say, what do you do? And I say, oh, well, you know, I'm a private consultant and I do this and that. And to say, oh, well, I own an ad agency. And I loved that moment when it got to that moment when I could actually say that and it was real and true. And so it was that type of thing, of that type of glory, of that growth.
Jeff, what's the real and true moment when you could say, I am the entrepreneur?
Well, I think certainly when you stop getting a paycheck from anywhere else and you're coming up
yeah.
with the money somehow to keep the boat afloat, you're an entrepreneur. And also, I think there is that moment when you realize that, you know, there's no such thing as paid vacation anymore. There are all these things that are gone. I'm kind of always working. And I think that's also where you have to remember to stop every once in a while. You know, the pattern we have is I work and then come home and get the, you know, have dinner and get the kids down. And then oftentimes I go back in and work. I mean, there's just too much to do.
Yeah.
But on Sundays, I stop. And what's really interesting is that Sundays I often think of as my best work day of the week because I'm working the rest of the week, but on Sundays, solutions start popping
yeah,
in my brain.
So your mind is freed, right, of the day-to-day stuff.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes on Saturday I'll be facing what I think is an insurmountable problem. I think finally, oh, here it is, the insurmountable problem. There's no solution to this. And then on Sunday I'll be not thinking about it, playing with kids or hanging out, and suddenly I'll be like, oh, well, of course, that's what I have to do. So you have to stop thinking every once in a while because as an entrepreneur, it's very easy to always be thinking.
Does this make sense to you guys?
Yeah. Well, and I think to tag and platform off of that, part of it is how do you stay relevant and how do you bring that creativity into whatever is the next step for you? And for me, continuing education and the discipline of looking at new information. I'll take classes at the University of St. Catherine, and, you know, I'll be speaking at a conference at St. Kate's, and then I'll sit in on a class. And I do the same thing when I'm keynoting at a conference. I will mingle around and go in and sit on the workshops just as a way to expose myself to other things and new areas. And I work primarily with organizations in the service industries, whether they're a nonprofit or a for-profit or a government agency. But by crossing disciplines of working going and looking at things in healthcare and finance and government, you see there are things that are similar and, oh, you know, they do this over here, and you start to cross-pollinate your ideas. And for me, that ongoing education is starts to get the ball rolling. But then my creative time is in the car. Sometimes I have long drives to some of the boards that I'm on or traveling to a client, and I've got notepads everywhere and little slips of paper. One of these days, the book is going to actually get written from all of them. And you capture that, and you figure out, what can I do? And that's where I find the mind flies.
When's your best creative thinking time, Nina?
It's on the spin bike.
Is it?
five in the morning or something. Yeah, it's very early. It's when you're kind of doing a repetitive task and you're using up a lot of energy and That's usually when I'm thinking, and I always think, oh, I wish I had a notepad right now to write down what I need to remember.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We've asked three entrepreneurs to come into the studio with the six things they wish they'd known when they started the business. Jeff Freeland Nelson with us, Jill Johnson, and Nina Hale. Okay, this is the time of the roundtable when I ask you what you're reading. We'll put your reading selections up on the Daily Circuit page. Nina, I'll start with you.
Well, my husband is a writer, so Boarded Windows by Dylan Hicks.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about it.
So it's a novel, came out last year on Coffee House Press, mm-hmm. and it is a sort of an orphan story, literary fiction.
Okay. So are you seriously just reading that, or did you bring that to...
I brought that to tell you because
okay,
I'm not reading
good.
It this moment. I've read it multiple times, though.
All right. Jeff, how about you?
So the funny thing is I'm actually working on writing a book. At the
Are
same
you?
Time. Yeah,
oh, my gosh. What, about this experience?
No, fiction. And and what I find fun about that is that it gives me that, you know, what creates creative time is that when I get my brain out of the here and now, I can go to this sort of fantasy world of dragons and robots that I'm writing about.
Oh, my gosh.
Suddenly, again,
companion
solutions
piece.
To problems here and now. So I'm spending a lot of time writing, but then really sort of sampling a lot of books at the same time. You just sort of pick them up. I was reading John Irving last night just because I just picked it out and went to a random page. And the book that I'm really digging into, I've read now three or four times, is Blindness by Jose Saramago, which I love that book. I've given away a half dozen copies of that book. And for me, it's inspiring.
Jill, how about you?
Well, I actually run a book club, and it's a nonfiction book club at the Minneapolis Club, and we've read over 160 nonfiction books since I started it.
Huh.
And the one that we read last month was just a fascinating one. It was called Girls of the Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II by Denise Kiernan. And it really crosses a perspective of that wartime era and the value of people and the psychology of secrets. And we have a psychiatrist who comes every month to our group. And so we always have just a fascinating discussion. Huh. And that really is, I find for me, one of the other resources to survive is reading biographies of other fabulous people who all walk through that dark moment where they weren't sure that their future was really going to unfold as much as they might have wanted it to, whether they were Thomas Edison or Benjamin Franklin or Joan Rivers. I mean, they all
quite appropriate through. For the conversation
Absolutely.
We just had, right?
And that was another part of my survival approach all those years was using those biographies as a way to give me that sense that maybe if I just continue to struggle on, that breakthrough would really happen.
I have to say, after hearing your schedules and how crazy this is, I am really grateful you took an hour to come in and do the roundtable. Really, I didn't know what an ask this actually was. So thank you all. Good to have you
pleasure.
Here.
Thanks
thank
so
you.
Much. Glad to be here.
Every Friday at 9 o'clock on the Daily Circuit, the Friday Roundtable. Another panel coming next Friday. Well, next hour on the Daily Circuit, we'll look at the lives of transgender youth. There's a new book that offers itself as a guide for parents who are raising and supporting transgender youth. We'll also get an update on a pretty violent night in Chicago last night. And at 11 o'clock, how do you keep a good online reputation or restore a bad one? That's all coming up this morning on the Daily Circuit.